This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's political GabFest portion of the show, the politics around the death of the American ambassador to Libya, and should Mitt Romney have kept his mouth shut?
I also believe the administration was wrong to stand by a statement sympathizing with those who had breached our embassy in Egypt.
Also, how real is the Obama polling bounce coming out of the conventions? I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, 71-year-old Bob Dylan is out with a new album. The superfan helps us assess it. Plus, the Harvard cheating scandal. Is it really that bad? And is the 20-year-old movie Sneakers actually an underrated masterpiece?
I can't speak for the other guys, but I'm in it for the money. I don't care if you go to jail.
Me neither. I'm in.
Could we maybe just go back to the they might kill us part?
Our show begins with the political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. And today we'd like to welcome the listeners of New Jersey Public Radio to the GabFest family. Welcome. It's a great family. We are thrilled to be on the air in the Garden State. Joining me today are John Dickerson, Slate's chief political correspondent and political director of CBS News. Hello, John.
Hello, New Jersey.
And also joining me from New Haven is Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
So we had an incredibly busy week in the news. The death of U.S. Ambassador to Libya, Christopher Stevens, in Benghazi. The protests in Libya, Egypt, Yemen, sparked by a really appalling anti-Muslim film made by, we don't even really know who it was made by. And, of course, Mitt Romney's response to it. That'll be our first topic. The second topic will be, did President Obama get a bounce from his convention? Plus cocktail chatter. The Middle East exploded this week in a series of events that moved too rapidly to track, especially for Mitt Romney, apparently. It moved too rapidly to track. Protests erupted in Egypt, in Libya, and now more recently in Yemen over a mysterious, highly cheesy American-made film that depicts Muhammad as a pedophile, a womanizer, a thug. The American embassy in Cairo was assaulted. The American consulate in Benghazi, Libya, a city that was saved by American firepower only a year ago, was attacked, and four American diplomats, including our ambassador, Christopher Stevens, were murdered. The Libya tragedy has, of course, become a political story as well, both because of Mitt Romney's response to it, which we will talk about, and also because of the echoes of 1980, this idea of an embassy in the Middle East or embassies in the Middle East being overrun by Islamic mobs and American dignity and might being threatened by that. John, let's start with the substance of what has happened. What are the protesters in the Middle East angry about? Do they have a right to be angry about this crazy film? And do these protests represent a serious threat to American interests?
Well, we have to figure out whether the protests are really about the film or about something else. There's some reporting that the protests were just a moment of opportunity for more long-term enemies of U.S. and U.S. interests, namely al-Qaeda, that they use the protest to just go after American interests, in which case the film really doesn't have much to do with it at all. Even if the film is a part of it, the idea is that there is this unfocused anger at the United States always waiting for the smallest provocation. That would separate the anger at this specific film from a longer standing threat. And depending on how, you know, big you see the threat, that's kind of what the big issue is here about Romney's reaction to it.
So, Emily, have you looked at the film at all?
No, I just read about it. I really didn't want to watch it. I mean, I probably should have.
Well, I'm just interested in this is a free speech question. Should we as Americans be, as Mitt Romney kind of was, stalwart and saying these people are fine? Mitt Romney, I guess, didn't exactly defend the film.
No, no. He was going for a political shot. It wasn't a free speech thing with him.
But what did he do?
It's a little tough to follow the bouncing ball here, but let's try. So basically what Romney did was there was a press release from the Cairo embassy sent out before anybody hit the street and started protesting, saying basically that the position of the embassy was that they, in strong terms, denounced anybody who would say offensive things about another religion. This was basically an attempt to show fellow feeling with the people who were upset by the film. Then after the attack started, the embassy sent out some tweets in which they said, we condemn the violence and, oh, by the way, we stand by our initial claim about the film and anybody who would denigrate the Islamic faith. The State Department didn't like the very first statement that came out before the protests started. It came out on September 11th, and it didn't have the right mix of we don't want people to be mean to Islam, but we also don't think that you should respond with violence to an act of free speech. The State Department, before they could get the language right, the statement was already put out by the Embassy of Cairo. Romney jumped in and said that not only did he deplore the violence, which by the time he made his statement at 10 o'clock on September 11th, there was one reported death, but then he also said that the administration response, which he basically limited to the wording of the very first press release from the Cairo embassy, that the U.S. response was weak and that they apologized. And the next day he had a press conference in which he reiterated that position, that it was a sign of weakness and that he had to speak immediately because this was such a great wrong.
Is it a sign of weakness, Emily, for the American government to essentially condemn a film, even a completely terrible, reprehensive, appalling anti-Muslim film made by an American?
Well, first of all, I don't think they did actually condemn the film in that way. But to answer your hypothetical question, no, I don't think it's a sign of weakness. I think we can say that we believe in free speech, but when that free speech is used to denigrate religious beliefs, we wish that it wouldn't be used in that way. You can both protect the right and regret that people, in certain instances, use it in such an inflammatory manner. What do you think, though? You're more of a free speech absolutist.
Oh, I totally agree. Now, the point of free speech is that you condemn morons who say really stupid things. This guy, this filmmaker who seemed to have passed himself off as an Israeli, which was odd, but seems to be an Egyptian Coptic Christian who, you know, made this for mysterious reasons, that he's a loathsome figure and what he is trying to do is loathsome. And the video and the people who are spreading the video appear to do it in order to incite violence. It was a deliberate provocation, and the U.S. government should do its best to make it clear that this is a view that's not held by the American government, that doesn't represent the American government, and is a despicable view.
Right. I mean, and the test for this is an obvious one, which is that if the people who were being denigrated were Christians or Jews, would we feel we wanted to condemn the speech? And of course we would. I mean, the other thing to sort of flirt with, I don't think it really works, but the test for whether you can actually ban speech is whether it poses a clear and imminent danger, whether you're shouting fire in a movie theater. And this almost is
Don't go there. Don't go there, Emily.
All right.
It's an offensive speech, but that certainly doesn't justify mobs of angry Libyans descending on the U.S. embassy.
No, I wasn't even saying that. I was just wondering whether it was possible to try and ban movies like this because they are such a clear incitement to violence. I know nobody wants to ban movies, but I'm definitely not arguing that the violence was justified because the speech.
Let me ask a question here. If you're operating in a culture in which you don't have the same views about free speech and your job is to protect Americans and you know that saying something would be the equivalent of yelling fire in a theater as just a pure security measure, why is it wrong to say, hey, you know, this is the equivalent of saying yelling fire in a theater? I mean, the rules of free speech, we still want to uphold them. But when you're talking about trying to quell violence.
But, John, this was a movie made by Americans posted to YouTube, an American-owned site. You can't possibly hold people responsible for things that happen half a world away.
Oh, but I'm not holding it responsible. I'm just saying whether some people thought that the statement put out by the embassy was not celebrating America's tradition of free speech. And all that the embassy said was basically we repudiate the views. They didn't repudiate the right to say it. They repudiated the attack, which seems to me to leave our own views and beliefs about free speech intact. I was just wondering whether you could construct a position stronger than the one that the embassy put out because it's a public security threat.
Right. You could argue, absolutely, we have to recognize that this speech is denigrating and insightful and horrible, and that's our responsibility in order to try and prevent this violence, and that we don't have to always, with every second breath, say, but we condemn the violence. Although, I kind of think you also do have to say that.
Let's move to the political impact of this for the presidential race. So Mitt Romney was criticized for how he reacted to it. John, do you think that net-net, over the long term, is what's happening with the violence in the Middle East and with Romney's response to it, do you think it's a gain for Romney politically because it does have these echoes of 1980 of Jimmy Carter? Or is it a loss for him because his response was considered by many people to be premature and unpresidential?
I think neither. I think basically we've had, although I'll address both of those thoughts. I think the Carter analogy doesn't work so well because inflation was much higher. His approval rating was much lower. Growth was in the negative category. And while growth is weak, it's still in the positive category. So in other words, the context for Carter's weakness in a foreign policy context was it attached to a broader feeling of weakness about Carter's presidency. Obama's approval rating is just at about 50%, which is much higher than Carter. People have still a good feeling about him, even if they don't approve of the job he's doing. So he's a little bit more durable. Also, you have a case here where Libya, presumably the government is still sort of on our side. This is a one-day overrun. It's not a long, protracted hostage process. Romney's problem is that he may have broken this code. But I think mostly we've seen in this campaign that these moments, they flare up for a minute and then the campaign and the polls just basically go back to where they were. And I think that's probably
yeah,
where
we'll talk
be
about that, I think,
week.
In the next segment. Emily, last question to you. So the Arab Spring, this great flourishing of democracy across the Middle East, and here we are a year later, and mobs in three different countries which were affected positively by the Arab Spring are attacking U.S. embassies. What are we to conclude about how what the end result of the Arab Spring is, and also what kind of policies the U.S. should pursue towards these societies?
Well, we don't have any kind of end result. We're so midstream or early days, and it seems kind of inevitable to me that the demise of the strongmen in these countries would leave just a lot of fomenting and chaos and room for extremist groups to rise up and make themselves known in crazy ways that it wasn't possible before. And in terms of U.S. policy, I mean, it's enormously tricky. It seems like inevitably the implications of this are going to be that the United States is going to be more reluctant to get involved. For example, in Syria, my friend Julia Kayyem, who's an opinion columnist for the Boston Globe, said, hey, you know, the real winner from all of this is Assad because he can sleep more soundly tonight.
It seems to me that the solution has to do with the kind of intervention that what these countries lack. They've created democracies. They've sort of stamped democracies on top of them. They lack civil society. So what
right.
we have to do is help them build civil society so that there are counterweights to religious extremist groups which provide order and structure and a way for people to live. And these, whether these groups are around professional organizations or whatever it is, that civil society is what is missing in these countries, not democracy.
I think that's absolutely right. And then the question is, can the United States in a useful way help build those institutions? Or is there a way in which, because we're America, tell and often tell people what to do, that we can't, this is their job, not ours? I don't think I believe that. I think there has to be some useful way we can get involved, but I'm sure that it's not obvious or easy.
Coming up, how real is the Obama bounce? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political Gabfest portion of the show. Let's follow the bouncing ball again, John. Mitt Romney came out of his convention sort of like a deflated balloon. There was no bounce, no nothing, no love. The Democratic convention universally hailed as a smashing success, at least in terms of many of the speeches given, memorably by Bill Clinton and
Michelle
Obama.
Well, not universally hailed.
Not universally, but like
many
widely,
of your friends thought it was
widely.
Many people in the Slate email chain thought it was neat.
Widely hailed.
The conventional wisdom was that?
It was a good convention. But it appears, at least when you look at the polling, to be kind of a bleh that President Obama experienced a small bounce, a couple of points, but nothing that could be called a major movement. John, you've looked at the numbers. I know you. You have like probably bathed in the numbers all week. You have washed your face in the numbers, used the numbers to clean your car. What do the numbers tell us about what happened after the conventions for the president.
Well, they basically tell us what the numbers have told us all year, which is that these big events, you know, the polls will move a little bit and then they'll settle back down to where they were, that we've got a weak president running in a bad economy and that he's going to always trade within the same range. Mitt Romney is a weak candidate who can't get above a certain percentage because of his limitations as a candidate and because people just can't seem to get a hold of him. The president did get a little bit of a bounce, and he got a bounce in the Washington Post poll in an interesting way, which is that his numbers relative to his own performance didn't get any better. People still didn't like his performance on the economy. They still thought the country was going in the wrong direction. But when you measured him against Romney, which is in the end, of course, what this is all about, he did better than he had done before the convention started, and particularly on various attributes they asked about him. He won on all the attributes, or fought Romney to a tie on things like handling the economy, cares about you, and those kinds of issues. So he came out stronger, even though his overall favorability number only went up a little. They certainly have reason to be happier in Chicago than they do in Boston.
Emily, this phenomenon of stable polls is really interesting. We've had a summer and spring, I guess, with a lot of news in it. It's not as though there haven't been real events and real things happening in the economy. And there have also been pseudo events about the candidates themselves and the way they've acted. And yet nothing has moved. Why do you think there is so much stability? Why is no one's mind being changed?
You know, here's an argument that this is actually like a really good thing. We have a divided country. People have deeply held beliefs about the size of government, about what to do about Medicare and Social Security, about taxes. And they are seeing through all the noise. We have had, you know, yes, a lot of events and maybe a few glimpses that are revealing about how Mitt Romney would handle the presidency. And then, of course, we see Barack Obama being the president all the time. But maybe these are essentially people who are going to say do what they say they're going to do. They're committed to two pretty entrenched different party platforms. The choice is clear. And all this other stuff is just like entertainment or boring, but it doesn't really affect this very basic choice that we have to make as a country. And people get that. And that's why they're not budging.
Although there's some evidence of the poll, people haven't taken full impressions of Mitt Romney, which means there are a lot of people who, or not a lot, but some people who just haven't engaged yet. I should note that the stuckness of the polls that's been kind of stuck since May has always favored the president by just a little bit. So while it's essentially tied and within the margin of error, when you have this many polls where even if it's within the margin of error, the president's ahead, I think you have to say that even though it's stuck in the middle, he's on the better edge of that and has been for a while.
Now, John, is it stuck in the middle because as a whole, the country has fewer undecided voters than it has ever had? Or is it because those undecided voters have
swashed around?
Have swashed around?
I think the answer may be yes. I think it's mostly that we don't have a lot of undecided voters. But there is some wiggle room, and there's some wiggle room depending on the state. So you have more of an undecided vote in Iowa than you would, say, in North Carolina.
Why would we be, do you guys think, why would we be a country that has sorted out its undecided voters? And my own theory about this, actually, as I realized as I asked the question, is, of course, that we've hardened our party ideologies. Parties have just become more strongly identified with particular views, and people have learned it, and that's what's happened.
Right. And the people who don't care to be involved in parties either aren't participating at all or haven't started participating, you know, and won't for a couple of months. But the number of people who participate but haven't lined up is still pretty small.
What I always find puzzling about the undecided voters is that it means, right, that there's no issue on either side that's so galvanizing to you that you can't imagine identifying with it, or that there are different things on different sides, but they don't add up to one package that you can't imagine identifying with. And I just never quite get that because the differences are really stark.
No, but they're not. For the undecided voter, we're talking about their low information voters. They think mostly about how terrified they are they're going to lose their job or how anxious they are that they've lost it and they've gone to 700 job interviews and haven't gotten one. They have no idea and no ability to sift through whether the business guy is going to get the economy going again or whether the guy who is more related to your world, which to say the sitting president, has the better scheme for getting them a job. They can't sift through all this stuff.
Right, but that's different. I mean, that means that there is an answer if you went and found it, but that these are people who don't know what that answer is because they lack information. That's fine. But that's different from what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, like, once you figure it out, how can you not have a gut instinct about which way you want to go?
And most people do pick because of the side. They don't do the math, as you were just saying, Emily. They don't like look at both policies. They pick the party or they pick the guy. I mean, it's mostly gut feeling. The rational voter does not exist.
No, that's why the event thing doesn't actually make a difference, because events come, and what happens is that events don't change people's mind. Events just confirm whatever particular position you already held. So, you know, if you're an Obama supporter, the weak job numbers prove that they need more time to get their economic plan in order and that the Republicans are destroying the economy. If you're a Republican, it confirms that President Obama is a terrible steward of the economy and we need to do this and that to fix it.
One quick just point about the polls being where they are and not changing because of the convention. The Romney campaign believed three things would change the polls. One was the pick of Paul Ryan, one was the convention, and one was the debates. Well, two of those three things have happened, and the polls haven't really changed. So there's this sense in the Romney camp and in the broader kind of Republican world that they got to get moving. And that may be one of the things that inspired Romney to jump in so quickly on Libya. This thing, even though it's 50 days away, is moving quickly. So,
Emily, last question to you. Given that the polls are very stable, that events don't seem to change minds, and that we're very narrowly divided, what should each candidate do?
The Democrats need to convince people that the unemployment numbers are going to go down if they're reelected and that they really have an idea for how to do that. And that was a thing that I felt like was lacking in the convention, at least from President Obama's speech. And I think that's like the big test for him in the debates. And I don't exactly know what his answer to that is.
I guess I would answer that totally differently. To me, the events and the issues don't change minds. So, in fact, they don't need to do that. What they need to do actually is spend all their money getting their voters to turn out and not worry about the substance of it at all.
Yeah, and the events are never going to get any better for the president. I mean, we had median income down 1.7% this week, which if Romney wasn't talking about Libya, would be what he would be talking about and probably should be.
Let us turn to cocktail chatter. When you were drinking heavily with your colleagues, as we did last weekend, what is the one remarkable fact you will dazzle them with? Dickerson.
The one remarkable fact is that given all the things that's happening in Libya, there was a climate scientist in Libya, Khalid Ibrahim El Fadli, I think. He's the director of climate department at the Libyan National Meteorological Center. He literally had to dodge bullets and protect his family during the revolution last year while doing research into whether the 1922 temperature measurement, which had a place in Libya being the hottest ever on record, 139 degrees. It turns out it's no longer the hottest place in the world. The records which he found a log from 1922, which turned out was not correct, and that then, as a result of debunking that finding, they found that now Death Valley has the hottest place ever on Earth. It was Libya. Now it's Death Valley. But just the idea of this guy so committed to his craft that he was dodging bullets to solve this riddle amidst a revolution. I love that.
That's a great chatter. Destroying a point of Libyan national pride, no doubt, in the process. Emily, what's your chatter?
My chatter is about Adrian Pine, who's a professor at American University who had a sick baby a few weeks ago, was in a bind in terms of childcare because she couldn't bring a baby with a fever to her daycare. Brought the baby to class. The baby kind of crawled around on the floor, put a paper clip in its her mouth. And then Professor Pine picked the baby up and started breastfeeding her in front of the students, which a student tweeted about. There was, you know, some kind of ripple of reaction in the student body. And then when the local newspaper made inquiries of Professor Pine, she took to the internet to write an essay with the unbelievably bad title of "The Dialectics of Breastfeeding on Campus, Exposing My Breasts on the Internet," in which she took great umbrage that anyone would question her decision and basically said, you know, I do this all the time in public. What offense, what problem could my students possibly have with this? I mean, I just feel like this is kind of ludicrous. I say that as someone who's done lots of breastfeeding, some of it in public. But the thing about breastfeeding is it is like a really distracting and activity that has to do with your breasts, which are, whether we like it or not, a sexualized part of the body. And so it seems to me like the rule with breastfeeding is always that it's incredibly contextual. You look around you, you think like, okay, can I kind of quietly and furtively do this without freaking out the people around me? And if you're standing up in front of a lecture of people you don't know, students for whom this is their first class, the answer to that question has got to be clearly no.
I was on her side until I realized, one, that the university basically said she could have skipped the class. Two, there was a great item that someone wrote in Slate just pointing out that what she was doing two things badly. She was both mistreating her child and badly teaching her students. And so she should have just picked one. and done it.
Right. It does seem like when you're lecturing, it is appropriate for university to expect that you're single-mindedly focusing on your students. You're not supposed to be looking at your phone, and you're also not supposed to be worrying about whether your baby has latched on properly or not.
That'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. I'm David Plotz in Washington, handing you over to Stephen, who's coming to you from a surprise mystery location this week.
Thanks, David. I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture GabFest, Bringing a Gun to a Puppy Fight edition. On today's show, Bob Dylan's Tempest is his 35th studio album. We'll discuss it with Slate's own in-house Dylanologist, John Dickerson. And then the movie Sneakers, it's 20 years old. Is it also an underappreciated masterpiece? And finally, the Harvard cheating scandal with Slate's own Farhad Manju. All right, before we dig in, I should say that we're joining you today from the Mohonk, the magical Mohonk Mountain House in upstate New York, the home of the Slate annual retreat. So we're going to sound a little different today. Inevitably, we're recording in a conference room. You may hear the sounds of birds chirping or underpaid, hungover staffers wandering by. So be it. And we should say that Julia couldn't join us today, so we're going to have a series of Slate colleagues come in and discuss each of these topics with us. Joining me, as every week, of course, is Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hello, Steve.
And joining us for our first segment is John Dickerson, who those of you on the listening on the radio will have heard in the previous half hour. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve. This is my maiden time, isn't it?
It is.
I'm a huge fanboy of the Culture GabFest, too, so I'm very nervous.
All right, John, let's dive right in. Tempest is Bob Dylan's 35th studio album. It came out this week. You've listened to this new album. There's a new video, which is getting a lot of press attention. What do you make of it so far?
I guess the first thing I make of it is that there's a huge body count. The number of people who are dying or who the narrator is going to kill or, I mean, of course, when you have a song about the Titanic, you have, you know, a lot of bodies there. But all of the songs, almost I think all songs, except for Duquesne Whistle, the first song, which also seems very much apart from the rest of the album, have, and then it ends with a tribute to John Lennon, of course, another body. All of Dylan's albums for the last 20 years have been focused in one way or another on death, but the death here is, it's more physical, it's more corporal, it's got people's names attached to it in a way that's different from his previous albums.
It's more political in a way, too. I mean, just in the sense that it's kind of a grander historical canvas than it seems like he usually works in.
Well, yeah, 13,
these days, that is.
Yeah, 14 minutes on the Titanic, the story of the Titanic going down is a, I can't think of it. Actually, that takes us back all the way to the beginning of his career when he used to tell long stories of historical events. You know, The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, all of those songs from the early 60s, which were retelling stories. Of course, they were contemporary stories. They were ripped from today's headlines. This one, of course, is much older.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we listen to a cut from the album? Why don't we listen to Duquesne Whistle?
Listen to that Duquesne whistle blowing. Blowing like's gonna sweep my world away. I'm gonna stop in Carbondale and keep on going. That Duquesne train gonna ride me night and day. You say I'm a gambler, you say I'm a pimp, but I ain't neither one.
John, it strikes me that one of the first things Bob Dylan wanted to do in publicizing this album was stress its violence. The video for Duquesne Whistle is built around two peculiar punchlines. A young man in a kind of Chaplin-esque way is trying to impress a young woman, sort of dancing up to her car, plucking a rose from a vendor and handing it to her. It fails utterly. She pays no attention to him until he knocks over a ladder, which injures another man. That man's hired henchmen come, kidnap the young, cute, adorable Chaplin-esque man, eat him on screen with baseball bats, kneecapping him on screen. It's grotesque in a way. And it's only after he's been beaten does the young girl show any interest. He's bloodied and beaten. Then the young girl suddenly is interested in him. And then the second peculiar punchline is that throughout the video, Bob Dylan has been wandering in kind of a lurid nightscape, urban nightscape. And right at the end of the video, he steps over the prone body of the young man and the two plot lines of the video suddenly intersect. What on earth? This is needs to be decrypted for me. Tell me what's going on.
It's fascinating because, I mean, in some sense, this album and his last few have been, he is the battered and bloodied one, and occasionally for love and for other things. And in this in the series of songs on this album, it's all about the struggle through carnage and violence and the ship going down and trying to retain and hold on to some little bit of dignity while it's all going to hell.
Mm-hmm.
And he, on the other hand, is the narrator, songwriter, Bob Dylan, is in some sense walking through on his own journey this mayhem, craziness, violence, and we can talk about this. It's all a journey to get home, which is a big Dylan theme and which is the opening lines to one of the songs. And it just this notion of trying to get home really strikes me in the song Narrow Way. He's talking about going back home. He wants to go back home, leave me alone. So there's a quote from No Direction Home, the film about him, and he said, "The home that I'd left a while back and couldn't remember exactly where it was, but I was on my way there. I was born very far from where I'm supposed to be, and so I'm on my way home." And that has been this steady strain through his albums. It shows up again here. And it's both a place, both musically, he's going back to these old forms. Passionately, he's trying to get back to a love. And also sort of artistically, he's trying to get back to somewhere he once was.
All right, let's ask the hard question, right? Bob Dylan is eternally relevant to you and me because we're a couple of old superannuated goats, right? But is that purely generational? Is Bob Dylan being forced down the throats of America serially in the final decades of his creative life only because he touched the baby boomer generation so totally and they can't get over themselves? And here we are forced once again to pretend that Bob Dylan has produced a masterpiece. Does he continue to produce masterpieces or only masturbatory criticism?
Well, this is the great tension in my fandom of him, which is that basically I'm attaching, Bob Dylan was the first thing that gave me a handle to attach to things, to love, to irony. So this is dodging your question a little bit. I think there are a lot of times, particularly in concert, when I've seen him and thought, this is actually very bad. This is just an unpleasant experience. The band is incredibly tight, but there's a way in which he growls that can be beautifully musical, and there's a way in which he growls that can be discordant and not in a good way, not purposeful discordance, but just unpleasant experience. And so I think with this album, I'm not sure where I come down on that question. I think Together Through Life, his last one, did have some real beauty and some great lyrics, and the jury's still out on this one.
Before I sound like a completely annoying automated naysayer on Bob Dylan, let me say that, and this is a roundabout way of telling this anecdote, but in Samuel Butler's Way of All Flesh, there's a character, if I remember correctly, there's a character who has status in his social grouping because his great uncle once laid eyes on Brahms, right? I mean, there's some sense in which, someone is so transcendently a genius that to just have seen them in the flesh, like their genius has gone so universal that the experience of seeing them as the particular individual touches you. I once saw Bob Dylan in the flesh on the street. I was walking on West 4th Street of all the places to run into Bob Dylan. I came around a corner. He came around a corner.
Are you positive it was 4th Street?
And we ran practically directly into one another. This was 12 years ago. He was built out of stovepipe. He was rail thin. He had these kind of lizardy, seen it all eyes and some kind of fedora and a gigantic Samoan bodyguard. It was wonderful. And they walked past me and I thought, I got to follow him for three blocks, right? Because what I'm going to see is everyone else having the experience that they'll tell their children, that they'll tell their children. That's the Brahms moment. Like I'm going to see people walking toward Bob Dylan and going, holy I just saw Bob Dylan. Like a moment that they will. So I saw like 50 people have a moment they'll remember the rest of their lives. Bob Dylan is with us and is with all of us. I love Bob Dylan. I just don't know if I can follow him here.
And so you were like one of the members of the posse walking behind him. Exactly. Which is when you're that guy and people are reacting like that, you have to basically ignore everything that's happening around you, which is why you maybe step over bodies.
John, we stepped over the corpses of young men who still get the girls.
It was like more like a film noir gangster or something. Get the girls, see?
Dana, I'm curious, on your iPod in between the Birdsong and Gamelon, is there Bob Dylan? And if so, what is the last Bob Dylan chronologically that you listen to with any regularity?
Oh, into this century, for sure. I mean, he's made some great albums in the last 15 years. I think it's the last album of his that I really loved was Love and Theft, probably, mm-hmm. or Modern Times. But I mean, I don't know that late Dylan, especially this album, because it's such a downer, it's so bleak and it's so unmelodic in parts that it's not something I would sit down and listen to. But the Titanic song, which I think we should go out maybe on a Friday, segment of, is a pretty ballsy thing, a 14-minute long ballad with no chorus that is just a composed through ballad that's just bleakly recounting one horrible death after another. I mean, it's almost comical in its awfulness, that song, and yet it's such a slog to get through it that then you find yourself being moved again in minute 10, but then you've got four more minutes to go. It's just, it's a crazy experience listening your way even once through that song, Titanic. I think we should go out on it.
John Dickerson, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's actually shocking that we've never had you on before. We will have you on again very soon.
Well, this may prove to you why it was wise not to.
Coming up, should Harvard just get over its massive cheating scandal? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. All right, well, moving on to our next topic. It is the 20th anniversary of the release of the caper film Sneakers. Sneakers starred Robert Redford as Marty Bishop, a modern Robin Hood whose career is breaking into buildings or computer systems at the behest of their owners in order to determine their security vulnerabilities. The anniversary of this movie is being celebrated the globe over by John Swansburg and Julia Turner. If no one else. We're joined by John Swansburg, the culture editor of Slate.com. John, the first question I have to ask you is, are you still drunk?
Yes, quite. Quite drunk.
Excellent. Let's proceed.
I was drunk when I assigned all these sneaker stories as well, as you can tell.
And drunk when you wrote your own contribution to them. And,
yeah. Right. I've been drunk for weeks.
Yes. All right. Well, with that established, Sneakers is now 20 years old, right? It seems to me that the key phrase in my little introduction for the film is that they break into both bricks and mortar buildings and computer systems, right? There's something about this movie is distinctively 1992. They're hackers, but that word barely exists, if it exists at all in 92. There's something dated about this movie, but dated in such a specific way that that's what it is that tickles your funny bone and Julia's funny bone about it. Why don't you explain?
I guess I agree that that's the key phrase in your own introduction, but I'm not sure it's the key phrase in my feeling about the movie, for the record.
John, take another drink. Relax.
No, I think that you're right, that it is the movie does feel dated in certain ways now, 20 years on. But my argument in the piece that I wrote for Slate, and I think Julia agrees, is that actually if you go back and watch this movie, it's surprisingly prescient about the technology age that was only dawning in 1992. It had intimations about the stakes for privacy, for government meddling in our lives. That was pretty impressive for the kind of movie this is. I mean, this is not Sneakers, if people don't recall, is actually kind of like a lighthearted caper movie. It's not some dark vision of a, you know, technology future where our overlords are going to be spying on us. It's sort of like, you know, Robert Redford trips over a desk and there's like some slapstick. It's kind of like a silly, lighthearted film, but it also had some really interesting ideas about what the future would bring, given that we're all about to be connected by computer.
But John, you and I both know that interesting ideas about what the future might bring do not make a good movie, and they don't make for a good movie experience. This is a purely subjective and peculiar aesthetic hobby horse that you and Julia Turner are riding in public. I need you to tell me what it is about this movie. This movie, I saw this movie when it came out. It strikes me as a completely innocuous piece of fluff. I forgot it the instant. I think I'd forgotten it before they got to the second act of the film. What is it about this movie that you and Julia have so bonded with?
So I've confessed that I'm drunk. Did you watch the movie again in preparation for this segment?
Hard truths, Metcalf. Hard truths.
I know Dana Stevens did.
I was up till 3 watching it, my friend.
Because why? Because it's so enjoyable and watchable?
I had already seen it at your behest a few years ago. You evangelically pressed your DVD of it into my palm probably 5 years ago or something like that.
And you've had it ever since.
I've had it ever since. Never
returned
it.
Download a new copy.
So now everybody knows not to lend me anything.
I've downloaded a copy of the film, and I've watched...
Well, that's good.
I've watched well in excess of a third of it.
But just to finish my story, I was going to refresh my memory last night by watching 15 minutes of it and reading a summary, kind of prepping for the segment, and I couldn't stop watching because Sneakers is just so irresistible and charming. I don't think we're getting at the spirit of it as we talk about. I mean, it's true that I think it is full of much more interesting ideas than most caper movies, right? It's not an Ocean's 11. It's got more substance and it's got more political allegory and it's got just better writing, I think.
Right. I mean, I think that's it. Like, we obviously in these pieces kind of harped on this notion of Prussians because it seems it's like an interesting way of lending some weight to our subjective opinion that this is a very fun movie.
And putting a shred of credibility over your editorial decision to run a six-piece package on Sneakers.
Yeah. But and I think in actuality, Julia and I, when we both discovered that we are fans of this movie, when we talk about it, we don't talk about, isn't it amazing how it really captured the connection between the counterculture and the hacker culture? We talk about how much fun is this movie? It's both sweet and suspenseful. And it has an incredible cast. I mean, you mentioned Robert Redford, but it also has Sidney Poitier, Dan Aykroyd, David Strathairn. One of the characters, the one played by Strathairn, is blind but has a heightened sense of hearing. In a series of setups, he kind of hears things that the other guys aren't able to hear because they don't pay attention in the right way, and he solves these puzzles.
Okay, well, let's pause for a second and listen to a clip from the film.
They threw me in a trunk, drove around in circles. It could be 100 miles away. It could be next door. It could be underground. It could be in a skyrise. Forget it.
Fish, what did it sound like?
What?
The road. When you were in the trunk, what did the road sound like?
Oh, I don't... Highway, a regular highway.
Well, did you go over any speed bumps? Gravel? How about a bridge?
Bridge? Yeah. Four bridges in the Bay Area.
Was the Golden Gate fogged in last night?
Yes.
Did you hear a foghorn?
No.
I think a huge part of the fun is the puzzle solving. The movie's exquisitely paced. It's like there's no scene is too long. I think that's probably why Dana had to watch the whole thing. There's no scene. There's no moment in the movie where like, okay, this is dragging on. I'm done. Apparently there is for you, Steve.
So what you're saying is it's a briskly presented tissue of cliches.
Yes. Fine. Or I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's, you know, something that it's not. It's not. All right. So we called it a masterpiece in our headline. Okay. It's not a masterpiece. But I think for me and for a lot of people, I mean, my Twitter feed was running over yesterday with notes from people saying, oh, my God, thank you guys for writing six pieces about this movie. I love that movie. I watch it every year.
It seems like there's a secret cult. Yeah. There's a small niche cult of Sneakers admirers who are going to come out of the woodwork with this package.
Yeah. And who have. And I think honestly, the reason is that it's that movie where you're looking at your wall of DVDs. You want to watch a movie with your wife. You don't feel like watching Manhattan for the 10th time. You don't feel like, you know, finally jumping into Battle of Algiers. And you're like, we'd want to watch a movie tonight after dinner. What's it going to be? And it's like, Sneakers is always my default. I know I'm going to love it. I know it's going to make me happy. I know the puzzles are going to draw me in once again. And it's fun to introduce to other people because whenever they watch it, they, you know, pleasure in it the way that Dana does.
There's a bleak Charlie Kaufman film yet to be made about John Swansburg's marriage and its relationship to the movie Sneakers.
I should confess, my wife actually didn't like it that much.
Every Thursday night, John makes us watch Sneakers.
Steve, you don't have a movie like that? There's not some movie that's your default that's like, I just want to spend 2 hours being pleased by cinema. I don't want to be made sad. I don't want to have some kind of crazy intellectual puzzle to solve. I just want to be, you know, transported.
Yeah, of course I do. It's Bertolucci's The Conformist, John. Dana... you have a shred of credibility with which to make some kind of a case for this film. Clearly, it's a very well-paced, very well-produced action caper with no pretenses to much of anything. What is it you like so much about this movie?
Well, I don't think, I mean, unlike John and Julia, I don't think I would have exhumed Sneakers from the ground for quite this much retroactive glorification, but I do think it's delightful. I feel no need to defend it, really. It just sort of seems like its pleasures are so self-explanatory.
Right, because like, who would bother to attack it? Steve?
But a churl.
I'm trying to think of a really, really nasty.
Steve is like bringing a gun to a puppy fight.
That's Tombstone material right there. He brought guns to puppy fights.
Don't get me started on Tombstone, another movie from the early 90s that I really love.
I will absolutely not get you started on that, John Swansburg. Have another sip of Bailey's. Good luck today, and thanks so much for coming on the show.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me and being so mean to my favorite movie.
All right, well, we're here at the Slate Retreat in upstate New York, and as a result, we're joined by a kind of magical series of Slate contributors to come in and talk about various things that they've written about or thought about recently. And the latest in these is Slate's tech columnist Farhad Manju. Farhad, welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
Last week, let me set this up a little bit. Last week, Harvard announced that it was investigating more than 100 students for cheating on the final exam of a course called Introduction to Congress. The class had a reputation for being easy, but many students found last spring's open book take-home exam to be close to impossible. As a consequence, the kids apparently began to break the rules. Some students now face the possibility of being forced to take a one-year leave of absence from Harvard. A university official has called the case unprecedented in anyone's living memory. Farhad, do you recognize those words?
Yes, those are my words. And cheated.
I cheated. Yes. I'm not allowed to appropriate your language. I'm not allowed to, under the color of collaboration, say that somehow what you wrote was fair game and fair use for me. You have written a column arguing that this cheating scandal has been blown up way out of proportion, and in fact what these kids do ought to have been encouraged, not only not discouraged and not subject to penalty, it ought to have been baked into the curriculum of Harvard University to turn them into collaborators. Farhad, what were you thinking?
Yeah, I'm arguing they shouldn't be called cheaters, because I think what you have to do is kind of look at what this exam was. They were allowed 3 or 4 days to take this final exam. The final exam made up a huge portion of their grade. And they were allowed to consult any material, even the internet, but not to discuss the exam with anyone else. So I argued that this rule is sort of inherently arbitrary. I mean, the internet is a product of collaboration. Everything you find on the internet, from Wikipedia to, you know, question sites like Quora, and pretty much, you know, Twitter, everything is people coming together and discussing things and writing, but it's, you know, it's a product of discussion. So the first point that I made is that it's sort of, you know, arbitrary to say that they can't talk to other people about this, but they can consult the internet. I think the larger point is that universities in general, the academy, should encourage people to collaborate, because, you know, we live in an economy where everything you do in the workforce, you know, whether you work in a corporate job or you work in government or anywhere else in science, you know, you have to work with other people. And often on things like this, on exams, when you're learning how to enter that workforce, you're not encouraged to work with other people.
I understand what you're saying. There's something kind of vestigial and arbitrarily, perhaps even puritanical, right, about this notion that we work alone, we sit at a desk, it's our own brain, our own conscience, our own creativity, and we bring it as a total solo practitioner to bear upon our, you know, exhibitions of our own excellence. And that this, in fact, has become obsolete, right? That if you look at how people actually create in the modern world, it's in a much more hiving, much more a networked way, and that the universities ought to move in this direction.
But if I'm not understanding something, though, I mean, how are they caught? How are these people caught? If what they were doing was just sort of an extension of collaborating with Wikipedia, obviously in some way their language resembled other people's language too closely, right?
There were some people who seem to have just kind of copied each other's answers, and I try in the piece not to defend those people. I mean, I think that's plagiarism. Some things they were doing is the exam had particularly tricky questions, like it used terms that were never taught in the course. So they had to ask their teaching fellows what those terms meant, and it seems like some people got the answers from their teaching fellows or from one another, and through that, maybe their answers looked similar.
So are the teaching fellows in trouble too?
I don't think the teaching fellows are in trouble, but the students' response to this is that the course was poorly run, and that some teaching fellows were good and others were very bad and didn't understand the material or didn't understand the exam. And so
it sounded, for what it was worth, I mean, this is not to justify what the students did, but it sounded like a terrible class, right? And many of the students before this whole scandal broke said in their evaluations it was the worst class they'd ever taken.
Right. There have been years of evaluations of this class that said that it was really poorly run and the exams were tricky and it was just not a great class.
But expanding out from this particular instance, right? I mean, one function of a university clearly is it's a talent sorting sieve, right? Mm-hmm. And effectively you're trying to figure out how individuals vary from one another, among one another, in terms of talent, initiative, et cetera, and then you hand them over to either the workforce or graduate study and beyond. Is collaborative study, can it really take on a formal element within a university setting without raising huge moral hazard and free rider problems? Effectively, you're going to have slaggards like Steve Metcalf who cunningly grab the coattails of bright, directed people like you, Farhad, and I'm going to get an A, you're going to get an A, and that's inherently unfair.
Well, I think that's, I think that could be a problem, and I think that's taking a dim view of collaboration. I mean, I think what probably would happen is that you won't have kind of smart students who'll give all the answers to less smart students. I think what you will have is people who know some part of the material and other people who know different parts of the material, and through their discussions might come up with some greater thought than you know what they could have done just alone. I'm not saying that you should abandon the idea of assessing kind of individual performance. You know, like an in-class exam where it's closed book and you're trying to get people to answer questions about science or, you know, organic chemistry or something like that. And that's a place where you do want to assess individual how well someone knows the material. But I'm arguing that there should be both, and probably there should be more formal mechanisms to assess how well people collaborate and to teach people to collaborate.
Well, Farhad, thank you so much for coming on the show. That was a total, total delight. I hope we do it often in the future.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's great to be here. I'm a big fan.
Wandering back in from the gift shop is none other than John Swansburg. John, thank you so much for joining us once more to endorse.
I couldn't stay away.
Couldn't stay away after the fusillade of abuse you took only moments ago.
Yes. Well, I would like to endorse a little 1992 movie. No, I'm just kidding. I won't. I realize this is a lost cause. But I am very happy to endorse a book, a new book. That I'm very excited about.
Right, well, I'm the host of the show, and I'll tell you when it's time for you to endorse. Dana, what do you have?
Burn.
Steve, I don't know what – you guys are rooming together, right, at this retreat? I don't know what transpired in that room, but
– And no
it was actually
one,
very collegial in the room.
And no one will ever know. Dana.
All right. I shall endorse today the Rob Delaney stand-up special live at the Bowery Ballroom, which he just started selling last week, Louis C.K. style, on a little site, robdelaney.com, where you basically just go – pay $5 and download the special. It's terrific, weird stand-up comedy. I don't know if you guys know Rob Delaney at all. Do you follow him on Twitter?
I follow him on Twitter, yeah.
He's sort of a Twitter comedian, basically, right? He's known for his Twitter jokes. I think he's hilarious. He's extremely prolific on Twitter. Not all of his jokes work, but he just has a very crazy, filthy, funny, absurd imagination. And so it's really interesting to see his stand-up if you are a Rob Delaney Twitter follower. And if you're not, I recommend you follow him. That's another endorsement, too.
All right, John. Your moment has arrived.
It's my turn?
It is. I'm cueing you right now with my index finger. That's what that is.
It's scary.
Go.
It's
Let's
scary.
Hear it. Endorse.
I'm endorsing a new book that is out this week called The Victory Lab by Sasha Eisenberg. Sasha, as some listeners might know, is actually a columnist and blogger for Slate, so I apologize if this sounds like I'm shilling for him. I do edit him, but his book is fantastic. He's written what I like to describe as essentially the Moneyball of politics. It's a book about how modern campaigns work, and it's not about speeches or polling or campaigning in the way we usually think about it. It's about the way that campaigns in the modern age are using data and targeting and all these new tools to figure out how to game the system and get votes. And Sasha wrote a great piece for The Times last week about how the bad thing about horse race political coverage these days isn't that it's horse race coverage. It's that journalists don't really know how to cover campaigns anymore because the campaigns are doing all these sophisticated things that don't get written about. And Sasha's written about them in this book. And it's a really fun read, but it's also, I think, a really important read to understand the way that politics works in 2012.
Oh, that sounds
it's really
terrific.
Great.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to endorse something. I'm going to double down, Dana Stevens. And I'm going to endorse something that I haven't read. I've touched it. It's a book.
You've already trashed a movie you haven't seen in 20 years.
Exactly, and this is my follow up to that. So my wife is a connoisseur of kind of upmarket crime fiction. Right, she recently discovered a hardboiled detective writer named Ross McDonald, very well known, very famous. Less well known, his wife was a woman named Margaret Millar, who was, and apparently there's this kind of mini genre of noir novels written by women. And some of them, my wife insists, are tremendous books and dying to be rediscovered. And one of her favorites was written by Ross McDonald's wife, Margaret Millar. It's called Beast in View. It is supposedly one of the truly greats of this genre. So not quite straight from the horse's mouth, but you got to trust me on this one. Beast in View, Margaret Millar.
Why should we trust you on that? You haven't read it. Your wife seems lovely. I'm sure she is a great pick, but...
As every character in Sneaker says, at some point you can't trust anybody these days.
True, exactly. You won't know who to trust.
John, I'm the host of this show, and I'll dole out the acerbic put-downs as I see fit.
Fair enough.
Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Dana.
Steven.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's show at wnyc.org/gabfest, and you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows in the iTunes store. Just search for Slate Podcasts. Our email address is gabfestradio@slate.com. GabFest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Mike Voilo and Dan Pashman. Our interns are Jeff Friedrich and Sally Tamarkin. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For David Plotz and the rest of the GabFest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. See you next week. He dreamed the Titanic was sinking
into the unknown.